Welcome to episode 85 of Practical Defense, Mailbag. Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I'm your host, Alex Addix. This week, I'm digging through the mailbag again and pulling out a few of my favorites to share and discuss. But before we read the emails, I have a little bit of housekeeping to cover. I want to remind everyone that the seminar I had planned for this month has been canceled. Now, Jim Wagner is going to be in town in the same week, and I recommend that everyone try to take as many of his courses as possible. I'm going to show up for two of them myself. When you have an opportunity to train with the master, you don't pass that up. I'd also like to apologize for the late posting of this episode. I didn't get a chance to record it early before I went away for the weekend on a boar hunt. I bagged two hogs, and they're both at the butcher's right now being made into some of the best tasting sausage I've ever had. I've yet to find anything comparable to wild boar sausage made by this particular butcher. I can't wait to pick it up at the end of the week. And if you're ever in the mood for a pig hunt in California, I have an incredible guide. His name's Roger Miller, and he owns and leases about 100,000 acres of ranch land outside Paso Robles. That's in Central California. He has more pigs than anyone, and we have always had a great time. If you want more information, just drop me an email, and I'll hook you up. I've been hunting with Roger for about 4 years now. He also guides upland bird hunts, and we're thinking about going back in November for a wild turkey hunt. I think it'd just be incredible to have a Thanksgiving turkey dinner with the bird that we collected. All right, we'll be right back and dig through the mailbag. Welcome back. Again, this episode is devoted entirely to emails I've received from listeners. The first is from Eleni in Thousand Oaks, California. Her message is in regards to episode 83 on apartment safety. She writes, "It's also a very good idea to check out the potential apartment after dark to look at the lighting of the complex. Good lighting on porches, grounds, storage areas, and laundry rooms, mailboxes, and parking areas deters crime. At night, a complex's true colors can come out." She makes an excellent recommendation. If you can, try to drive by the building at night to see what it looks like in the dark. See how it's illuminated and what types of people are hanging around. An entire neighborhood's personality can change depending upon the time of day. Thanks for sending that in, Eleni. The next email is from someone who asked to remain anonymous. He or she gives us some detailed firearm safety tips. Most firearms, particularly handguns, can be locked up with a simple padlock when not on your person, for self-defense, or in use. I prefer this method to a trigger lock for several reasons. First, installing the trigger lock can actually fire a loaded weapon. I know the instructions say not to do this, but if it can be done, then sooner or later it will be, even by the most careful person. Second, most trigger locks can be attached to something else. Finally, I don't trust that the firing mechanism of the gun cannot be overcome by a sufficiently motivated person. For instance, can someone whack a cocked hammer with a hammer or other implement to internal parts to break and fire guns? So here's how to lock up a gun with a padlock. I usually like to wrap mine with double-sided foam tape of the type often used for light-duty hanging pictures on walls. Then, I'll cover that with electrical tape. This is probably overkill. You probably really don't need to do anything. A semi-automatic pistol can be locked up with a gate lock. This is one of those locks with a long shackle, usually 5.5 inches, about 14 centimeters for your international listeners. Thanks, Anonymous. That's kind of nice. Take the magazine out of the gun, rack the slide, and if possible, lock it back. Now slide the opened end of the shackle through the ejection port and down through the magazine well and lock the lock. Now, the gun cannot be brought into battery, firing configuration, without removing the lock. A revolver with a swing-out cylinder and top strap, which is most double-action revolvers, can be locked by an ordinary padlock that is locked around the top strap. You cannot close a cylinder without removing the lock. Therefore, you cannot line up the cartridge with the firing mechanism. Some single-action revolvers can be locked by placing a padlock through the space in the trigger guard behind the trigger. You cannot do this while the hammer is cocked. Then, once a padlock is in place, the hammer cannot be cocked because it's connected to the trigger and the trigger moves back. A better solution is if the gun has a top strap, then remove the cylinder, like you're going to clean it, and lock the strap as above. Most Derringers can be locked by opening the action and locking the padlock around the hinge. This usually takes a large size lock, perhaps with a longer than normal shackle. All of these methods can be used with a chain or cable, such as you'd use to lock up a bicycle. I keep a bicycle cable in my car, under the driver's seat, wrapped around the seat posts, one end threaded to the loop on the other with a padlock through the free end. If I need to go somewhere and I cannot carry my pistol, like a courthouse, to renew my CCW permit, I can unload it, lock it as described above, and stuff it and the magazine under the seat and go take care of my business. This is not legal in all states and probably not legal in most countries. Also, for a little more, you can purchase them from a locksmith with replaceable cores so that you can have them all keyed alike and then occasionally change the keys on all of them. For airline travel with a pistol, I have a large, lockable case that can be checked luggage. It's locked with padlocks. Inside is another case locked with padlocks, per regulations. And inside that is the pistol locked as described above. It exceeds regulations. Ammunition is a manufacturer's carton which is inside another hard case, but not locked, which meets requirements for the regulations. I try to pack the case so that all electronic gear, the case with the ammunition, and the case with a pistol are separated and laid out so things are obviously non-threatening and not connected on the X-ray. But as a backup plan, the padlocks are all keyed alike except the padlock on the gun itself. Then after I declare the firearm to the front desk people and put the gun notice inside the outer case, I ask to wait until the case has been cleared by TSA. Occasionally, I've had to give them a key so they could open the case. They would not let me be present in some airports. They get the key to open the cases, not the one that opened the lock on the gun. A request for the other would have gotten a demand for the supervisor from me. Again, there are some states I don't travel in with the gun. Check the laws and make sure you're following all federal and state laws. I promised a quick tip. Perhaps this one isn't so quick. Nope, not quick, but some very good information nonetheless. And thanks for sending it in. The next email is from Patrick in San Francisco, California. He passes on a tip he picked up from lifehacker.com. He writes, Lifehacker posted this tip that I thought wasn't all bad, and I was wondering what you thought of it. If you don't have an alarm system at home and you can hear or see someone lurking outside, you can hit the panic button on your car to make a racket and hopefully scare off the miscreant, wake up neighbors, etc. Obviously, it presumes that you have such a car alarm and that you can get to the key safely without putting yourself in the path of the intruder or as his yet unseen accomplice, and that you end up in range of the transmitter. But I think every advantage you can get is good to try at least. Oh, and I asked my wife and my mother if they could operate their car panic buttons. Both of them fumbled around for a good bit. Wife finally got it. Mom gave up. Familiarizing yourself with that feature on your car key is probably a tip unto itself. Well, Patrick, I've actually had this tip brought to my attention on and off for many years now, and I'm really not a fan. First, as Patrick points out, there is a huge list of presumptions. You know, by the time you hit your second if, you need a better plan. There are so many inexpensive options, some costing as little as $10, that are better than this. It really invalidates the valuability of a car alarm as a home security device. I mean, do you really want to wake all the neighbors because you mistook a cat digging through the garbage for an intruder? If you actually see someone poking around, your first action should be to call the police, and the second is to hole up in your designated safe room. I don't think it would ever occur to me to actually reach for the car keys, but I would definitely reach for something else. And thanks for sending that in, Patrick. Now, the next two emails come from Carson in Canada. In his first email regarding disaster preparedness, he writes, while you're talking about emergency preparedness and food supply storage, you could mention the value of having a hunting gun and a few hundred rounds of ammunition on hand. A large food supply can take up a lot of space, but you and I both know that you can get a lot of food with a modestly sized collection of hunting supplies. And he's completely correct. Some disasters can take weeks for relief to arrive. For a major earthquake disaster in Los Angeles, it could take as much as a month for help and supplies to be distributed to the major metropolitan areas. The outskirts and suburban areas might take longer. You could be on your own for a long time. Even when food does arrive, it often comes in the form of cheap carbohydrates such as rice, wheat, corn, and flour. It'll keep your belly full, but for long-term survival, you need proteins. You'd be surprised at where you can find edible critters when you really look with a hungry eye. For people in urban areas, you don't need a full-on hunting rifle that can drop a wild hog. All you need is a .22 rifle or even a high-powered pellet rifle. Where I live in suburban Los Angeles, we have crows the size of turkeys, raccoons and possums the size of small dogs, and coyotes the size of German shepherds. Here's a good example. On the reality TV show Survivor, which teams always had the most energy and were able to function the best? Both teams always had rice, but the teams that performed best are the ones that managed to get proteins first and early. It's something to consider when you put your disaster preparedness kit together. And that's not even considering the personal security aspect of having a firearm around for protection after a major natural disaster. In another email, Carson writes, I remember you talking about taking pictures of accidents, saying that with the cell phone cameras, people don't need disposables anymore. I can tell you for a fact that police officers still use film, and for one big reason. You have a hard-copied negative with film that cannot be altered easily at all, and it will stand up in court. However, digital pictures do not have such a hard copy and will more often than not be disallowed as evidence in court because of the fact that they can be fudged without any backup. For this reason, I still have a disposable camera in my glove box. And Carson is correct again. Film is better than digital when it comes to evidence, and better than film is Polaroid, for those that are old enough to remember what that is. However, my understanding is that depending upon the type of case, digital is becoming more accepted, fender benders being an example. However, in a more serious case where life and limb or substantial monetary loss is in question, digital probably won't stand. You know, but things are going to have to change. We are quickly approaching a time where film and its processing are hard to come by. Even at amusement parks, they're starting to sell memory cards right next to film and disposable cameras. In the next 10 years, we might even see film completely disappear. Carson is correct in his statement, but something is better than nothing. And even if the court doesn't accept them, you can share the images with your attorney and your insurance company. You can also use a digital camera or cell phone to document the license plate numbers, pictures of the driver and passengers, the location, and all sorts of other things. All of these will be useful in building your case, even if they're not admissible as evidence. Thanks for sending those in, Carson. They are both excellent points. I'm going to close with clearing up some misinformation. Occasionally, I get emails with supposed safety tips. Now, while these are passed on with the best of intentions, sometimes the information is just plain wrong or even dangerous. The rule of thumb is you can safely assume that 99% of the warnings you receive in email are total crap and incorrect. There are two places you can check for the validity of email alerts. For computer viruses, check the Symantec Antivirus Research Center at sark.com. They have an online virus encyclopedia called Threat Explorer that includes descriptions of the virus hoaxes. And for just about everything else, check out Snopes.com, Snopes.com. Now, I recently received some misinformation in the form of a safety tip about two-way mirrors. Now, the message talks about how a policewoman gave a talk somewhere and how to detect the two-way mirrors in a bathroom and dressing rooms. But the core of the message reads, place the tip of your fingernail against the reflective surface, and if there's a gap between your fingernail and the image of the nail, then it's a genuine mirror. However, if your fingernail directly touches the image of your nail, then beware, for it's a two-way mirror. No space, leave the place. So remember that every time you see a mirror, do the fingernail test. It doesn't cost you anything. And Snopes has it listed as a false statement. Here's the response from the Snopes article. It's actually quite long and detailed, so I will just read a portion of it. And I'll put a link to the full article in the show notes so you can read it for yourself. But here's the main portion. Transparent mirrors are most obviously distinguishable from ordinary mirrors in that they're not hung on walls as ordinary mirrors are, but they're set into walls or doors as windows are. In other words, if there's a wall behind the mirror is almost certainly an ordinary one. A transparent mirror would be part of the wall itself. Also, the lighting in front of the transparent mirror must be much brighter than the lighting on the other side, where the hidden observers are, for it to work effectively, and some light leaks through from the brighter side to the dimmer side. According to the folks at MirrorPane's technical support group, you can use these factors to your advantage by pressing your eyes up against the mirror and cupping your hands around them to block out the light from the room you're in. If you're dealing with a true transparent mirror, you should be able to see at least a little something of the open area behind it. Also, wrapping on the mirror should provide an oral clue. Ordinary mirrors have backings and are usually placed against walls, so wrapping on them will generally produce dull thuds. Transparent mirrors are set into walls with open areas behind them, so wrapping on them should produce a more open, hollow sound. These methods of detection are more reliable than the fingernail test and should be preferred to taking the chance on getting arrested for property damage after tossing a chair through a perfectly normal mirror misjudged via less accurate means.
Gun Rights Radio Network has the best pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun rights podcast available on the net. The podcasts are absolutely free when subscribing using iTunes or Zoom Marketplace. Or if you want, you can just listen from the website. Make sure you visit gunrightsradio.com to subscribe. Podcasting freedom, one episode at a time.
And as this is a mailbag episode, there's no summary this week. I do, however, have a preview of sorts. Episode 87 is going to be an interview with Steve Pender of the Martial Art Masters of Texas podcast. We discuss and analyze his survival of a 3-on-1 criminal attack where two of his attackers came at him with weapons. It's a great discussion, and I'm certain everyone's going to enjoy it. As always, don't forget to check out my monthly column on TaekwondoTimes.com. It's called Raising Awareness. And again, I'd like to thank everyone for sending in their wonderful emails. I really appreciate them. I love getting them, and I love sharing them with everyone else. If you have any tips you'd like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you'd like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexaddix.com. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware, stay safe. Practical Offense is a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network at gunrightsradio.com. And that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions, commentary, and topic suggestions, send an email to podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexhaddix.com.